had a hard time finding a talk that resonated with me. But I did find three talks that were on Iris's laptop, and they were some talks that Ajahn Jayasaro gave at Wapananuchat, and so I picked one of those. It was given in 2008 to the community there, but I think it's applicable to everybody. It's called Kanti, Patient Endurance. One of my favorite, very short stories is of a seeker of some kind coming across a wise man and engaging him in conversation. At the end of their conversation, the sage reveals from within a carefully folded piece of cloth, a most incredible jewel. The young man, the young traveler or seeker, is absolutely dazzled by the jewel and says, "Can I have this jewel? Would you give it to me? It would make so much difference to my life." And the old man says, "Sure," and gives it to him. The young man is very excited and afraid that the old wise man is going to change his mind, so he hastily says goodbye and sets off on his travels. But then an hour or two later, the young man reappears and approaches the old sage with great humility and respect, lays the jewel down in front of him on the ground, and says, "Excuse me, but I'd like to make a trade. I'd like to exchange this jewel." And the sage says, "What for?" "I would like to exchange this jewel for knowledge of how to gain the sort of mind that could give up a jewel like that without a second thought." I think it's the kind of awakening wisdom that we see in that young man's mind, which has led all of us towards the holy life. To see that jewels and worldly wealth and fame and fortune and comfort and relationships and so on and so forth are not worth, in the Pali idiom, 1/16th of the value of the kind of mind that can experience that deep and lasting contentment without them. I feel that it's very important that we return again and again to refresh ourselves with the inspiration that led us to give up the worldly life in order to follow this path, and to allow that to nourish our minds, particularly in those times when we begin to feel a bit overburdened, or as if we are not really getting anywhere in the holy life, or that things are not quite working out the way that we hoped that they would, or expected that they would. I agree with the teaching, and I know this wouldn't go down with lay Buddhists, that it is better to be a miserable monk than a happy layperson. The reason is because the misery of a monk is misery with an end. The misery is not inherent in the living of the holy life, but it is a phase or one part of the journey for most of us. Having such confidence in the process, in the overall journey and the goal, and the value of sticking with it, is absolutely essential. When I was first here in Northeast Thailand in late 1978, living at Wat Nong Bapong, I couldn't speak the language, of course. These days, the monks that go to Wat Nong Bapong are blessed with patient and skillful translators. I didn't have that at all. I remember my first three-hour Dhamma talk, sitting puppy up, which is a weird, awkward kind of posture when you're not used to it, and being absolutely fascinated by Ajahn Chah's gestures and his tone of voice, and what was obviously a deeply sincere effort to transmit the Dhamma to his listeners. So I asked a junior Western monk who spoke quite good Thai to give me a summary of these 3 hours. And he said, "Oh, just the same old stuff, talking about patient endurance." In fact, I had heard this word, oton, oton, before. It's about the first Thai word that I learned. The young monk's dismissive summary said as much about his understanding and general level of faith as anything else. But as a summary of a three-hour talk, it wasn't at all satisfying to me, as you can imagine. Nevertheless, it was true, and as I learnt the language, it became more and more obvious to me that the vast majority of the teachings were not the so-called high Dhamma, but were firmly founded on the practice of the monastic observances. Ajahn Chah talked a lot about living together in harmony, being scrupulous with the Vinaya. When the profound Dhamma did come, there was a great sense of joy and enjoyment. You didn't hear it so often that you took it for granted. But those monks who felt that the real Dhamma is the high Dhamma and that everything else is just padding and filler, which is not really worth it because it was just about core Wat or just about patient endurance, they missed the boat. They didn't catch on to what the teaching was about. Patient endurance, Kanti in Pali, is a singular kind of wholesome Dhamma in that it holds no obvious or immediate charm. It's not the kind of Dhamma that inspires your heart to feel uplifted and enthusiastic the moment you hear its name. But yet, as we know from the Owada Patimokkha, the Buddha gave central importance to this virtue. In the Owada Patimokkha, Kanti is called the supreme incinerator of defilements. So if we were completely logical, rational beings, which we are not, obviously, we would be incredibly interested in this quality. Given that we have ordained with the intention to realize Nibbana, when the Buddha tells us plainly as he possibly can that the main causal factor for the realization of Nibbana is Kanti, you would think that Kanti would be a major plank of everybody's practice, the main strategy, and the thing that one devoted the most time and attention to developing. But that is rarely the case, isn't it? For instance, when we are asked, well, how was your tudong? Or what was it like doing this kind of practice and that kind of practice? We may answer, well, I didn't get much out of it, apart from a bit of otong, a bit of Kanti. It's as if Kanti is the consolation prize. What you comfort yourself with having developed when you don't get what you really want from a particular practice. That's why I think that revising, looking again at the whole topic of patient endurance, is very helpful. To this day, with Lungpa Liam being such a fine and consistent disciple of Lungpa Cha, patient endurance still is the backbone of the training at Wat Nong Bapong. It has always been, and always will be, I'm sure. One point I would like to make right away is that the Dhamma Vinaya is a vast and complex organic whole, and that we seriously misunderstand it when we start to abstract particular practices, particular Dhammas, from the whole and look at them in isolation. Individual Dhammas can be explained and defined point by point, but that is not enough. Regarding the whole structure of practice, we have to be able to see what a particular Dhamma does, what its role is, what its relationship to other Dhammas is. If we compare it to the simile of the chariots, it's to ask, where does this Dhamma begin and where does it end? With patient endurance, one of the important things to remember, of course, is that the wisdom faculty has a very important role to play. It's not always the case that we should be patient, endure, put up with things. There are other Dhammas and other criteria to bear in mind, too. You shouldn't just bear with lustful or aggressive thoughts. You need to deal with them immediately. Let me give another example, the case of physical pain arising in meditation. This is a common concern for practitioners and meditators. To what extent should you bear with physical pain, and when should you change posture? Should you just stick with the pain? There are occasions where it's not a good idea to bear with physical pain. If it's going to have long-term physical consequences, for example, as when you have some physical illness or problem with your knees. Likewise, patiently enduring the pain might not be such a good idea if you are just getting really depressed with having to sit through pain every time you meditate. You want to be able to maintain a sense of buoyancy and interest and enjoyment of meditation. But having said that, bearing with a certain amount of physical pain in meditation, just a certain amount, not just changing posture immediately when you feel discomfort, bearing with it for a while before you change, even on this level you are developing, vaccinating yourself, gradually developing an ability to be with the uncomfortable and the unpleasant in an unruffled and natural kind of way, which expands naturally into an ability to deal with the unpleasant in daily life. Physical pain is the grossest kind of comfort, the most tormenting, but there are also valuable lessons to be learned from bearing with mental and emotional pain. The reward or value of it is the enhanced ability to see through pain, proving to yourself that pain has an end. To see that one can come out of pain like emerging from a tunnel affects your attitude to pain in general, and even to death. Most importantly, it helps us in our investigation of the nature of dukkha. The texts say that the reason why the characteristic of dukkha is not obvious, is concealed from us, is because of change of posture. Being still, being patient with the natural phenomena arising in the body and mind, means allowing for the appearance of dukkha. By doing so, we can understand more clearly its all-pervading nature. On this level, it's very clear that the constant small movements and adjustments that we make to our meditation posture are a reaction, a response to dukkha. I'm not saying that we shouldn't ever do this, that we never scratch an itch or never move when we feel uncomfortable, but whenever we do, we should recognize again and again exactly why we are doing so. This is dukkha. Every time we move or we see somebody else move, we can remind ourselves, this is dukkha. This is the manifestation of dukkha in the various postures of the five khandhas. Wisdom can arise right here. Now, before going on to one or two other areas in which kanti patience is exercised, it might be a good idea to give a definition. What exactly is patience? One of the definitions that I like and use myself was given by Lungpor Sumedho. It is peaceful coexistence with the unpleasant. I think that this is a very skillful definition in that it prevents us from looking at patience as just gritting our teeth and just bearing with something until the bell goes or there is no longer a need. If that is the case, and there is a lack of acceptance and stillness around the unpleasant, then it doesn't really fulfill the characteristics of kanti, at least in its role of an incinerator of defilements. If your eyes are still on the clock, your ears on the bell, there is a sense of time and wanting to get away from something. But not doing it yet, trying to prevent oneself from doing what you really want for as long as possible, I don't think that that's really what kanti is all about. Kanti is more about being able to develop a way of dwelling with unpleasantness in a way that the mind feels normal and unruffled and at peace. This is the paradox and the challenge. Can you be at peace with something which is agitating, which is annoying, which is calling out for you to be averse to it? If you can, the wonder of it is that suddenly you see that you just don't have to react to things. There is no hard and fast causal process here. We can see that by simply looking at the fluctuations in our emotional reaction, we can see that by simply looking at the fluctuations in our emotional reactions to things. There might be somebody or something which really rubs us up the wrong way, something that irritates us quite out of all proportion to what might be reasonably expected to be the case. But our level of irritation and upset is not stable. With the mind, you can see fluctuations. Perhaps in the morning, you're really in a good mood. You had a good meditation, and you see somebody behaving in a certain way or something happens, and yes, it doesn't really affect you. In the afternoon, you're a little bit tired, you're a little bit fed up, something has gone wrong, you see the same thing and you have a much stronger reaction. The intensity of the reaction is not solely the function of the irritant. It's a dual production. One part, and it is the important part, is coming from within. It's affected by our own mental state. This is our great opportunity. So we try to develop that patience and patient endurance, that steadfastness, that groundedness of mind, which is not jumping around with delight at things that we like, or pulling away and shrinking from, or flaring up with anger at things we don't like, having a sense of just being there, very calmly being present to our experience. Then we begin to see that there is nothing out there which can force a particular emotion to arise in our mind. At most, we may be subject to a very compelling invitation. We can feel that someone is giving us a very strong invitation to be angry, or someone or something is giving us a very strong invitation to feel greedy or lustful, but it's not compulsion. This is where the opportunity for freedom becomes very apparent. We see that if we keep doing this work and we keep plugging away very patiently, very methodically, and calmly, our ability to not receive the invitation, to not react blindly to that impingement, becomes stronger and stronger. And our sense of self-reliance, the sense of being our own refuge, becomes more and more real. Our meditation practice gains immeasurably from the intention to develop kanti. Without it, insights don't take root. With it, they do. So we learn to cherish this quality of kanti, the steadfastness and willingness to be with the unpleasant without pushing it away, without rushing towards it, just being there with things, not giving too much importance to the emotional tone of the experience, but more the whole structure, the flow of the experience. So we are taking Kanti as a spiritual ideal, as something that we really want to develop in our practice, and seeing the value of Kanti has significant results. In terms of the areas that we exercise this quality, I have spoken already about unpleasant physical sensation, and I've spoken a little bit about the reaction to external stimuli. And of course, there is the dealing with mental states arising in the mind, irrespective of externally stimulating things that arise within meditation. Generally speaking, we need to have the ability to be solid, present, and peacefully with things that are irritating, annoying, and unresolved. Often things are in an unformed state that we can't really work out yet, and there is that very strong tendency to want to have an answer for things straight away. We want everything to be worked out, to be neat and tidy. The ability just to leave something, to say, yes, I don't have the wisdom, the ability to come to any firm decision about this. I'm not quite able to deal with this effectively. I'll just leave it there for the time being. This is an aspect of Kanti which I think is often overlooked. You may remember the practice of Lungpur Samedo in his first year here at Wapananachat. When this meditation hall was first built, there was no Ajahn Skuti. He lived in a little room at the back of the meditation hall. You can imagine how little privacy he would have had. Anybody could just knock on this door, including any lay people coming into the hall. So Lungpur Samedo was living in that room, and it wasn't as extensive as it is now, and he had a project of making a bowl stand. Of course, with the entrance into the rains retreat, all kinds of projects, including ones like this, were halted for 3 months. So he was determined to get his bowl stand completed before the rains, and he was getting more and more frustrated and was making more and more mistakes because he was rushing, wanting to get it finished. He had just got to get this done. So he relates how he stopped, realized the state his mind was in, and made a deliberate determination to put the whole thing down. An 80% or whatever finished bowl stand, and what's more, to put it in full view by the side of his shrine, so that he could see it every day and be forced to develop the ability just to be with something which is not quite finished. I have always admired that as a practice. It may not be in one of the lists of the special ascetic practices, but it really is a tough one to do. When there's something that's not quite finished, that sense of unresolved business is annoying, isn't it? You want it over and done with. You want the tidiness and resolution, and everything to be as it should be. It's important not to believe in that, but to see it as a defilement of mind, as something that leads you to be sloppy, take shortcuts, and to be impatient and lacking in precision and care. It is the practice of Kanti that can expose and eliminate this kind of movement of mind. Through not following this craving for closure, we see how it conditions dukkha. Keep noticing that it is not that we're bad or that there is anything wrong with this tendency. It's completely normal and natural for the mind to shy away from the unpleasant and to move towards the pleasant. But as long as we're doing that, we're stuck in the realm of samsara. The definition of bhikkhu, which Lungpur Cha liked to quote and expound upon, is that the bhikkhu is one who sees the danger in samsara. He was not advocating we practice discursive meditation on the danger of birth into different realms, or a contemplation of Buddhist cosmology, as much as talking about samsara as we experience it, moment by moment. In our daily practice, samsara is that simple condition and undiscerned movement towards the pleasant and movement away from the unpleasant. A bhikkhu is one who goes against the stream of that habit. There's another beautiful traditional story about Kanti that I'd like to relate. The story begins with a certain arahant who loved solitude and didn't fulfill certain obligations to the Sangha. He was, as I remember, living in a cave and refused to attend an important meeting. As a consequence, he was called before the elders and given a punishment. He was told that he should start going on alms round to the house of a certain Brahmin who had wrong view, great anger against, and contempt for Buddhist monks. The monk asked, "And how long shall I do this for?" The elders said, "Just keep doing it, just be patient." So every day the monk would go to this Brahmin's house and stand in front of the house. When the Brahmin saw this Buddhist monk, he got very angry and shut up all the doors and windows and told all his family members under no circumstances should they ever give food to Buddhist monks, and to this Buddhist monk in particular. So the monk stood there in front of the shut-up house for a reasonable length of time and then returned to the monastery. He went the second day, and it was the same. And the third day, it was the same. But because he had been given this practice by the Sangha elders, he was very patient, and he kept going day after day after day. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. Then, in the seventh year, the old servant in the Brahmin's house died, and a new cook was hired. The Brahmin said to her, "There is a Buddhist monk who comes and stands outside the door every day. Don't, whatever you do, give him any food. We in this house have nothing to do with him." Early the next morning, the Brahmin set off on his business. The monk arrived in front of the house and stood there quietly as usual. The new cook peered out through a window slat and felt very uncomfortable. She walked out and started to shout at the monk, "Be off with you, you shiny-headed fool," and other such coarse words. That day, as the monk walked back to the monastery, who should he pass on the road but the Brahmin? The Brahmin noticed that the monk had a smile on his face, and he immediately started to worry that the new cook had gone against his wishes and given the monk something to eat. So he said to him, "Hey you, monk, did you get anything at the house today?" "Yes, I did." The Brahmin was furious. As soon as he got home, he called the new cook in to see him. "I thought I told you were not supposed to give anything at all to that monk. Why did you disobey me?" "I didn't. I didn't do anything." "Well, so what happened? Did you just stay quietly behind the closed windows?" "No, I did more than that. I went out and told him off." The Brahmin got back on his horse and rode back the way he came until he caught up with the monk. "You lied. You told me that you got something in my house and you didn't. You're not only a stupid Buddhist monk, but you're a lying Buddhist monk as well." He was very angry. The monk answered him calmly, "No, I didn't lie. I have been an alms round to your house for 7 years and received nothing at all. Today, for the first time, I received something from its inhabitants. Some words of abuse. It's a start. While considering that, I smiled." At these words, something shifted in the mind of the Brahmin. He suddenly became inspired by the monk as he reflected on how the monk had been patiently coming to his house every day for 7 years without once being given any food for his daily meal. And now, on being abused, rather than getting angry, felt grateful. The Brahmin got down off his horse, bowed, and asked for forgiveness. Then he said, "Venerable sir, tomorrow would you please accept food at my house?" The Brahmin went home and told his wife that tomorrow morning, together with her 7-year-old son, she would put food in the monk's bowl. It became a daily practice. The young boy put food in the bowl every day, and filled with faith took ordination as a novice, became a monk, became an arahant, and became Venerable Nagasena, one of the pillars of Indian Buddhism. It seems that the elders who gave the monk the punishment knew that a baby with great barami had been born to a hostile Brahmin family, and this was their means of creating a connection between the child and the Sangha. This monk was willing to do this practice out of faith, and faith is an important cause and condition for Kanti. Have you ever noticed in your mind or asked yourself, why is it that in certain areas of our life, our monastic life, or at certain times, we can be incredibly patient, and we are able to deal with discomfort and things we don't like? And at other times, it is very difficult, and we are very unwilling to be patient. Have you looked at the causes and conditions why that should be? I suggest that one of the most important factors is whether we see something as worthwhile, whether we perceive it as meaningful. As soon as you start thinking to yourself, "Why bother? It's not going to make any difference in the long run, so why put yourself through this?" the moment you have that, "Really, what's the point?" kind of attitude, you lose all your endurance. But if you see the value of something very clearly, you can be quite remarkably patient. We can see this with parents and their children. There are incredible accounts of the endurance of mothers trying to protect their lives, the lives of their children. When there is something that is really meaningful to us, a really strong motivating force, we can bring up immense amounts of patience. But if your mind slips into unwholesome thinking, or ayoniso manisikara, unskillful thought, it can completely undermine our whole capacity for patient endurance. Patient endurance is, in other words, not only conditioned by how tough you are, or how good your samadhi is, or whatever, but by your ability to reflect on experience, the ability to think about things in an intelligent and useful way, and to create a sense of purpose and meaning, and to invest faith and confidence in that process and in that goal is what will support and sustain Conti, patient endurance, more than anything else. I forgot to mention, I did some editing out because it was a long talk, so I hope I did okay doing that.
Any questions, comments, observations?
It's not about Conti per se, but the word punishment jumped out at me. That was Ajahn Mun Sarva, twice, and I was just curious if you have any thoughts around. I guess what it comes up is, like last Vasa Dasha that came up during the Vinaya classes, sort of holding different rehabilitative measures in the Vinaya as punishment.
Right.
But from, I don't know, it's sort of.
I think sometimes in the English, in English language perception of some of those Vinaya procedures that they consider, sort of looked on as punishment, but really is much more of a rehabilitation or a period of separation in order to facilitate reflection, as opposed to how we conceive of as punishment. Also, in the, I'm not recollecting how Ajahn Jayasaro was using the word punishment, but there's also one of the words that is used in Thai, and then it tends to be relate to the Thai translation of a Pali term, like the Adinava Asada and Patinisika, sort of the seeing the benefit, seeing the harm, and seeing the way out of something. The word that is often the word that harm in Thai is told, which is sort of like an easy translation without thinking of context, is punishment. So that sometimes there's also, I can't remember the context that Ajahn Jayasaro was using, but that is another aspect of punishment, is also the harm in something. Because we might do something that's harmful and not really recognize that we're actually creating a punishment for ourselves or punishing ourselves for. Just by creating something harmful, it's sort of almost a self-imposed punishment. So there's two different sort of aspects of that, the way the word might have been used. And I think it's good to reflect on as well.
Does anybody know where this kind of story comes from? I'm not familiar with this.
Which?
This bhikkhu and this Brahmin, this...
Oh, to me it's got to be the Visuddhimagga, I would think.
It doesn't say.
It doesn't say. But also say like, because wasn't Nagasena the monk who was responsible for the questions of Melinda?
Yeah.
Yes. So he's... So like the Melinda Bandha was written and compiled by Nagasena, so that having a whole mythology around somebody that influential, helpful. So I think it's in Visuddhimagga. But it could also be in the actual, say, commentary to the Melinda Bandha.
I remember one of my college professors was talking about, like, in Catholicism, the excommunication. Mm-hmm. You kind of think of that, like, project of kind of expulsion, punishment. he made the point is that it's self-excommunication.
Mm.
You know, like when you do the act, you are, you know, the song isn't kicking you out, you are kicking yourself out.
So right. That's sort of
yeah.
A,
yeah.
Could you provide some guidance on when to patiently endure and when to use discernment to deal with what's coming?
Wholesome dumbness increase, not wholesome dumbness decrease.
Yeah, so it seems like they're not mutually exclusive.
Yes, this is true. It's always going to, there's always going to be a mix. And there's going to be some confusion. Because the unwholesome dhammas seem to be more, they're much better at advertisement, advertising. And the wholesome dhammas.
Yeah, I like the phrase in there, I forget exactly how to phrase it, but like I said, if someone's abusing you or giving you some sort of, you know, saying something unpleasant, it's an invitation to experience an emotion.
Yes, 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 yeah, really. Yeah, it's not a, it doesn't have to be, it's not a given result. It's sort of you've been invited and you can choose to pick up the invitation or not. And of course the course of wisdom is to, it's sort of like the, you know, like Ajahn Chah's, the story of Ajahn Chah being, you know, the, his palms being read by the fortune teller, and says, oh, by the lunch, you've got a lot of anger. And he says, you know, Ajahn Chah, yes, but I don't use it. It's a, the invitation is there from former habits, but it's not, you don't have to use it. Okay.